Time is an issue. Being late, an occupational hazard. For some, it is the unforgivable sin. Time, we need more of it. 8 days a week would be good, as the Beatles suggested. Time is quite clearly the dominant theme of the first half of Ecclesiastes chapter 3 that we've just read. We've been discovering how this book looks at different aspects of life to discover the meaning of life. Well, obviously, no commentary on life would be complete without some reflection on time. Some see these verses as sheer poetry, sort of music to our ears, a wonderful reminder to react appropriately in every situation. So in the business meeting, remember verse 7? There's a time to be silent and a time to speak. Well, there's advice that could have saved many a young executive in their career. And then more obviously, when your colleague's been bereaved, remember verse 4. That's the time to mourn. It's certainly not the time to laugh. Wise words about how we use our time? Is that what this is? Well, it sounds grand, but it just doesn't work. Oh, yes, this is poetry, but it's not the sort of poetry you'll stick on your fridge door in the kitchen to give you a warm, fuzzy feeling when you read it. Because look at verse 3, a time to kill. And verse 8, a time for war, a time to hate. Now, this is not a series of mini thoughts to remind us to act in the right way at the appropriate time, because it's never the time to hate and never the time to kill. No, these first 8 verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 3 demonstrate how we are captives of time. That time controls us rather than we it. And look at how these verses begin in verse 2. A time to be born and a time to die. Those are activities that you and I have very little say over. I didn't choose when to be born, and apart from the obvious exceptions, most of us don't choose when to die. Well, the reality of verse 2 hit me very forcibly last year. On the 10th of July, my wife woke in the early hours of the morning in extreme pain, telling me she thought the time had come to give birth to our twins. Yeah, it was a time to be born. Well, let me assure you, we didn't choose that time. It was 5 in the morning, and I wanted another 3 hours sleep before I went through the ordeal of childbirth. Well, and I knew it was going to be a tough time for Caroline as well. I remembered how at the antenatal classes, the midwife had told us that the first baby always takes a long time to come, so I rolled over and went back to sleep. But our girls were having nothing of it, and nor was my wife. It was the time to give birth, and boy, am I pleased we got a move on. But you see, verse 2, a time to be born and a time to die. I don't decide those things. Well, again, I was reminded of it last October when I had a telephone call one Saturday morning from my dad telling me that my grandmother had died in the night. A time to die. I had no say in the matter, and I know it wasn't in my grandmother's plans either. She'd been talking to me only a few weeks before about spending Christmas with us and her new great-grandchildren. Verse 2 makes it clear then that this chapter is not a series of wise sayings reminding us to react appropriately to different times and in varying circumstances. Verse 2 sets the tone for all these verses. The teacher presents the stark reality. We're caught in time. Time rules us. So, verse 2, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal. See, there comes a time when the shepherd takes the knife to the animal that he's nursed back to life. Time to kill, a time to heal. And verse 3, a time to tear down and a time to build. Well, that must be referring to bank holidays. That's when the nation visits DIY stores. Well, seriously, we tear down when something's worn out. And things wear out through the passage of time. What a lot of work we'd save ourselves if time didn't take its toll on things. So there again, we see that time has its effect on all that we do. And verse 4, there's a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. See, we've already seen, we don't choose when to die. So it goes without saying, we don't choose when to mourn. Indeed, if it was up to us, we'd never mourn. Who likes grieving? And a time to dance, verse 4? Well, I'm noticing the joints getting stiffer in the mornings. So as far as I'm concerned, dancing is concerned, my advice is do it now while you can. Well, again, do you see, these are not choices that we make. We don't choose when to mourn. We're forced to by time and circumstances. And verse 5, we read a time to scatter and a time to gather stones. A time when the collector disperses his hoard. And again, verse 5, a time to embrace and a time to refrain. There sometimes comes a time when friends part in bitter conflict, but no one set out with that aim in mind. And verse 6, time to search and a time to give up, a time to keep and a time to throw away. Fashions come and go, don't they? And as my colleagues keep telling me, it's time to throw away this tie. Only because the times have changed, though. Believe it or not, once upon a time, this tie was in. Well, maybe it's the time to keep this tie. It may come back into fashion. But again, do you see the point? It's the time that dictates our actions. And what of verse 8? A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. There comes a time when the peace-loving nation must prepare for war. But did they want it? Not a bit of it. Now, do you see how the teacher is showing us that we're imprisoned in time? There's a time for everything, verse 1. But when you've been around a while, it becomes obvious that someone else has drawn up the timetable. We think we're in control because we can spend time any way we want. But even then, we can only spend it once. And look, the reality is we can't choose always how we spend our time. I may plan to spend the summer having a wonderful holiday, but if tragedy strikes, it may be, well, a time to mourn or search or mend or heal. Despite my plans, it may be the time to give them up. So if we're trapped to this time scale that someone or something else seems to control, well then, the writer writes, verse 9, what does the worker gain from his toil? It's the same question that we faced in chapter 1, verse 3. In chapter 1, we saw the cyclical nature of the world. Everything keeps going round and round, and we can't change it. The seasons come and go. Autumn always follows the summer. Nothing we can do about it. It'll be the same next year. It was the same last year. The sun rises and the sun sets. We can't stop it. That was chapter 1. Well, here we move from the cycle of the world's seasons and weather that we can't affect to the marching of time that we can't change in chapter 3, verse 9. What does the worker gain from all his toil? We can't stop time. Time takes its toll on all of us, well, except, of course, Cliff Richard. But in time, the rest of us will all end up with a furniture problem, with our chest in our drawers. Time waits for nobody. It has a curious hold over us. We can't beat it. We can't make it go quicker. Do you remember when you were a kid at Christmas time? How you longed for the Christmas night, Christmas Eve night to pass so you could see what Father Christmas had brought you? Well, that was when you first discovered that you can't make time go any quicker. And you know it now when you have a boring day at the office. It won't speed up. And we can't make it go any slower. Well, lovers know the pain of that, don't they? Those moments that you'd love to bottle. Those times you'd like the clock to be suspended so that you can spend that perfect moment forever with your loved one. But we can't slow time down. Indeed, it's during those times that you think time has a mind of its own. Just when you want it to slow up, it seems to go all the faster. Isn't that the grim reality behind many a midlife crisis? Your life's slipping away faster and faster and you can't do a thing about it. We can't travel back through time to live again those wonderful childhood years so free from responsibility and cares. And when you're a child, you realise you can't project yourself into the future to be grown up and not have to do what mummy and daddy says. We are slaves of time. The passage of time leaves us trapped in this world. The truth of it can be so overwhelming sometimes that life seems nothing more than doing time. Verse 9 then, we can't change a thing. When it comes to us and time, we're like sprats before a super tanker. There's no way we'll stop it. Well, face the fact that time always wins, however we, and we'll never beat it or outlast it. And we have to conclude verse 10 with the teacher, I have seen the burden God has laid on men. We do feel burdened by it, sometimes bored because we have too much of it, other times stressed because we have too little. But why does time bother us so much? I mean, it doesn't bother the animals. And my cat never bothered about time. He didn't achieve anything in his life, but it didn't bother him. He didn't get depressed about getting older, about his life slipping away. He didn't go through a midlife crisis. He just lazed around. He never felt he had to achieve anything with his day. See, the animals aren't bothered by time. But they are, of course, just as much trapped in it as we are. Verse 2 is as true for the animals as it is for us, a time to be born and a time to die. Why does time burden us so heavily, as we read in verse 10? Well, the answer's there in verse 11. Do you see it, verse 11? God has set eternity in the hearts of men. See, unlike the animals, we know something of eternity, enough to compare the fleeting with forever. We're made for eternity. As a lad, when I was only 9 or 10 years old, I can still remember grappling with this whole issue of eternity. I can remember vividly saying to a friend of mine, there must be something after death. I can't imagine just not existing anymore. Well, here in verse 11 is why I had those thoughts. God has set eternity in the hearts of men and women. Since those childhood musings, I've come across it many other times in other people. Most obviously, when I talk to the bereaved, when I'm taking a funeral. People who've had no interest in anything other than the things of this life are suddenly very interested in eternity when they're faced with death. Sometimes when I go and visit people for a funeral, as I've got my dog collar on, they'll say to me, you know, I'm not religious, but I've tried to be good. They're sort of saying, you know, I've not really had any interest in eternity. I'm not really religious. And then, referring to their loved one, they'll say something like, but he's in a better place now, isn't he? I will see him again, won't I? See, eternity matters when we come face to face with death. God has set eternity in our hearts. We know it instinctively. And that is why the marching of time bothers us. Derek Kidner magnificently describes it like this. He says, we are like the desperately nearsighted, inching their way along some great tapestry or fresco in the attempt to take it in. We see enough to recognize something of its quality, but the grand design escapes us, for we can never stand back far enough to view it as its creator does, whole and entire from beginning to end. Now, do you see, that is a brilliant example, an explanation of verse 11. We see the beauty of all that we're living in, verse 11. Yet we cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end, the end of verse 11. We can't make sense of it. I remember the teacher is looking at life as if God were not involved, life under the sun. Yes, acknowledging that God's there, but concluding that he's not really interested in our little lives. Life viewed that way leaves us confused. We catch a glimpse of the beauty of the world, verse 11, but verse 11, we can't make head nor tail of it because we're trapped in time. We know there's something bigger, for God has set eternity in our hearts. Now, I would guess there'll be some here who instinctively know that. Maybe that's why you've been coming to lunchtime services over these last weeks, or maybe just come today. You sense deep down that you're made for eternity, but you can't quite work it out. And you feel frustrated by that, restless deep down. Well, if that's you, you're beginning to understand why Augustine prayed this prayer to the Lord. He prayed, "You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." Well, if you have that restlessness in your heart, will you speak to one of us afterwards? We'd love to tell you more. See, the point is we're made for eternity. That's why time bothers us so much. We can't settle with the thought that not only are we finite, but even how we spend the little time we have is dictated to us because of the circumstances and situations that we find ourselves in. We hate the obvious conclusion that if nothing is permanent, we're only filling in time. But without God involved, that's what we're left with. Without God involved, the writer says, verse 12, I know that there is nothing better for men than to be happy and do good while they live. Make the most of it while you can. Enjoy yourself. Do the best you can while you can. Have a blast while it lasts. That's the sum of life if God is not involved. But add him to the equation, and we read verse 13, everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God. Oh, the believer accepts the same truth of being driven by time, but not as a stopgap, but as an assignment. It's a gift from God, an allotted portion in life. No, we'll not fully grasp the meaning of everything, but we know God has a purpose. How can I enjoy the temporal things of life? The writer says, look to the eternal, things that endure forever, as he says in verse 14. Look to the God who does nothing in vain, verse 14. His plans need no corrections or amendments. And God exercises his control over the world so that, do you see it there at the end of verse 14, so that men will revere him. Well, it's the sort of thing that we saw last week. God has put eternity in our hearts so that we're restless with time until we finally turn to him. Because when we turn to him, we can find satisfaction in our toil, as it says there in verse 13. When we turn to him, we can know that the timetable has been drawn up by a loving heavenly Father, one who astonishingly works all things together for good for those who love him. He knows how it is, how it will be, and what has gone before, verse 15. See, it says, whatever is has already been, and what will be has been before, and God will call the past to account. Isn't that last phrase crucial? The Heavenly Father calls the past to account. So all the injustices of time will be dealt with one day. Even the hate and the war and the killing of verses 1 to 8, they will be dealt with. Nothing is overlooked. That's how we deal with the tyranny of time. Look to the Father of eternity. Knowing the truth, the certainty, and the security of eternity, that's how we have peace in a world that is far from peaceful.